Jacob Hamblin lived a life of adventure, in one sense. He came to know the Indians of the Southwest so intimately that many of his friends described him as taking on the traits of Indians. His accomplishments, his exploring, his diplomacy with Indians made him a legend in his own time. But he also lived a life of paradox, as he tried to act both as an Indian missionary and as an explorer and colonizer. These roles sometimes conflicted. Some might argue that they always conflict. Todd Compton, A Frontier Life. Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
It's time once again for another fabulous round of Before They Were Famous, highlighting the lives of prominent Mormon colonizers and pioneers and their origin stories. It's too bad we can't go back in time and bring in Robin Leach to narrate these episodes. Wouldn't that be a great touch? Lifestyles of the rich and pre-famous. I can't do an accent. Today's edition features two famous Mormon movers and shakers, Jacob Hamblin and Jane Manning James. Both were born about the same time, both have names that start with the letter J, and both arrived in Nauvoo around the same period of time. But other than that, their lives have very little in common. Still, we feel that each of these characters is important to know about because each of their lives tells us something different about the larger story of Mormonism.
First up to bat is Jacob Hamblin, not because the dude has to preside in this episode. He would later be known as a prominent Western pioneer who helped settle much of southern Utah. He was an important colonizer, doing outreach to local tribes, most notably in Tooele and southern Utah. His relationship with indigenous tribes as an Indian interpreter would place him in a sort of legendary status in the Wild West. But before all that, he had a relatively underwhelming start. A poor baby being born on the wild frontier of the United States, like many white Mormon converts.
He was born in Salem, Ohio, April 2nd, 1819. His Christian name was Jacob Hamblin. He would live a poor frontier upbringing. He was the quintessential frontiersman. When I watched the cartoon of Disney's American Legends, he's like the Mormon Johnny Appleseed. He was 6 feet tall, hardly educated, carried a pan for a hat. Just kidding, he didn't. But as biographer Todd Compton writes, he left an incredible amount of diaries, autobiographies, and letters. Whereas other frontiersmen, most in fact, left no primary documentation at all. Now might be a good time to talk about Jacob's early conversion experience. All Mormons have their conversion experience. Even if you're born into the faith, you have one the day your heart was converted to the gospel of Christ. Let's talk about Jacob's. I've read hundreds of accounts like his before, and before I understood the broader context of this history, I assumed that every American was like a Methodist or something. They were just going about on the edges of America, completely content and confident in their beliefs, and then they found Mormonism and went through a spiritual struggle with Mormonism that answered their questions. That's how a lot of our pioneer ancestors' accounts read, like they were all just sitting around waiting and seeking, and then there it was. But the truth is, there was a movement on the larger American frontier. You had all these consolidated Puritan communities, but with Western expansion and colonial occupation, there were all these new confluences of ideas and practices and behaviors and beliefs. Spirituality was coming in from all over the East, and Americans were interacting with other immigrants traveling from all over the world, bringing their practices with them. When you can't all meet in church in a church house because you're all spread out on the frontier, the religious becomes less community based and you're sort of left to your own devices. Hamblin's family was no exception. As a young boy maturing into adulthood, Jacob had a lot of questions regarding the meaning of life. One night, he's said to have had a dream where he saw a, quote, person of smiling countenance who gave him two books to read. And yes, they were both Cleon Skousen, Naked Communist and Naked Capitalist. He really knew very specific dreams.
All right, fine. Jacob would later interpret this as the Book of Mormon and the Bible. No, Skousen. Actually, at first he saw them as the Old and New Testament because he didn't have the Book of Mormon yet. For a while, Jacob flirted with the Baptist sect. But, you know, I guess that means no speaking in tongues on the first date or whatever.
That's a juicy joke right there. Speaking in tongues on the first date.
Speaking in tongues.
We know the strength of you says about that. No speaking in tongues on your first date.
Tongues. He would later have several mystical experiences that solidified this belief that God was looking over him. Now, like our friend from earlier, Mr. John Doyle Lee, Hamblin also spent time working in the Galena mines. Apparently that was the cool thing to do. In 1838, he survived a cave-in 200 feet below the surface that killed a friend who was working alongside him. He vowed he would never go back into the earth again after that. See, as a kid, I absolutely loved digging holes. Okay, fine. As an adult, I still like doing that. But I have to think that would have been absolutely terrifying.
You know, I send that story to our friend Jeremy Tucker, who grew up in the Kingston Group working in a mine, and he survived a cave-in. And I was like, hey, Jeremy, guess what? Sorry to trigger your deepest trauma.
Shared trauma.
And so I was telling Jeremy about it, and he was telling me all kinds of cool facts about the cave-ins that we don't have time to share today. But yeah, that would have been a terrifying thing, especially in that time period.
Yep, first person I thought of.
Back to our friend Jacob Hamblin. He would marry a young woman 3 years his junior named Lucinda Taylor, which is a very Mormon name. The marriage, though, was unhappy for reasons unknown. We know that his parents opposed the match, and this is what Hamblin had to say about it, quote, "The 3rd October 1839, I married Miss Lucinda Taylor, young and little experienced as I was myself. This was contrary to the feelings of my parents. When the marriage ceremony was over, I felt condemned for what I had done. I would have given all I possessed if I could have been freed. Thus, I was paid for my disobedience in that I had no joy in the wife I had taken," end quote. That's a rough quote. It's a rough quote for your first marriage. But the couple had one son, Dwayne Hamblin. Did I put that in? Is his name really Dwayne?
Yeah, that was you. So I'm...
Okay. Dwayne Hamblin. Couple had one son, Dwayne Hamblin, who was the first of 24 biological children, according to Todd Compton. When your kids can play a soccer game with two full teams plus one sub for each penalty kicks... Yeah, that's a crap load of kids.
What's funny, though, is there's not really, you don't really run into all that many Hamblins today. So they must be really spread out or something. Another brilliant point that Todd Compton makes in his book is that conversion to Mormonism in the 19th century wasn't just a spiritual and community affair. It was a geographical conversion. When you joined the church, you left everything to gather with the saints. When Hamblin converts to Mormonism, he was living in Wisconsin, so not a super common place. It just so happened that Mormon elders Elisha Groves and Lyman Stoddard were in the area. Since the Packers were still 80 years away from being invented, dudes in the Cheesehead Land had to find other sources of entertainment. Exotic Mormon missionaries in town? Check. Realizing they had more scriptures than just the Bible sealed the deal for Jacob. Again, the Book of Mormon and the appeal it had, very big. But when he goes home to tell Lucinda about his desire to join Mormonism, she told him she would leave him if he joined. So much for being a helpmeet, Lucinda. Freaking lady. Jacob opted to choose the rite, and on March 3rd, 1843, he was baptized. Apparently, it was the Book of Mormon account about the Lamanites that really impacted Hamblin for the rest of his life. The origin and destiny of Native people was a big interest to white society generally, and I think modern Mormons underestimate the impact the Book of Mormon narrative had as a result. Also, word is that Hamblin was super pissed in the spirit world when he heard about the change with the Lamanites being among the principal ancestors of the American Indians. So as a result for his conversion to this new religion, Elder Hamblin was rejected by most of his family, as well as many of his neighbors. However, Lucinda did come around and joined him in being baptized. Fairly soon, they bid a screw you Wisconsin farewell and left to join the saints in Nauvoo. And I love this story. Apparently, when Jacob first arrives in Nauvoo, he does what everybody does. He goes to the buffet at the hotel. Just kidding, wrong century. He went to meet Joseph Smith, obviously. Here's the account, quote, "A boy told him where Smith lived, but warned him to not take any money with him or Smith would get it. Hamblin thought this was curious advice and asked the boy if he was a Mormon. He affirmed that he was, and the son of a high priest. Zing! I'm too slippery. I do not slip
in. I get lonely. You can't touch me. That's not the only fun story from this era. So I hang out a bunch with FLDS, and they love Jacob Hamblin, by the way. He's a hero in those parts. And I was sitting out one day after we'd done a service project down there. We were sitting around the campfire, and I was like, you know what? We have so much in common. We really have so much in common. Like, I used to judge you guys and think that you were way off, and we just have so much in common. And so we're all smiling. It's a great day. We all got along. And then one of my FLDS friends points at a satellite. He says, do you see that satellite right there? And I was like, yeah. He was like, that's where the government puts people down in the middle of the earth. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he was like, you heard about the Israelites and the center of the earth. And I was like, no, I haven't. And he told me this whole crazy story about the government uses satellites to implant people and they're part of the lost tribes. And I was like, huh, maybe we don't have as much in common as I thought. And for years, I thought that was such a silly story and Warren Jeff's gobbledygook. But no, reading Hamblin's biography from Todd Compton showed me that this actually comes from somewhere. Joseph Smith Jr. called Hamblin on a Missouri mission, on a mission among the Indians, and he was apparently set apart by both Joseph Jr. and Sr. And here's from the book. Quote, according to Hamblin, Smith also told him there was a hollow in the North Pole where a part of the earth had been removed when the 10 tribes were taken. And when the 10 tribes, part of the planet, was returned, the earth would reel like a drunkard. I had no idea the story came from Hamblin. It was kind of exciting to see.
I have problems with this. Junior and Senior ordained him, or set him apart, but Senior had died 2 years earlier. That's a problem.
Oh, no. Really? So is Hamblin lying? Because we know Todd Compton is solid.
The important part is there's people in the middle of the earth, though. I'm getting distracted from the larger point here. See, the thing is, if you let Mormons write the screenplay to Journey to the Center of the Earth, it turns out very different because there's, you know, the tribes of Israel living there. It's a much better movie.
If you ever need to know the satellite, that you keep an eye on that one because that's where they send them.
Government.
I don't know how the government factors into the tribes of Israel, but it somehow.
It makes sense. I mean, if you just think about it for a minute.
Maybe that was Warren Sr.'s blessing and it got lost when he died 2 years before he gave it.
Sealed portion of his blessings, so. Now, here's the thing. Hamblin wouldn't serve the Indians as a missionary, at least not for a while. He sets out with some other elders to the east to help stump for Joseph Smith, who was, you know, running for president of the United States. Yeah, we'll get to that story. Friend of the podcast, Spencer McBride, actually just published a book about that whole thing, so it's quite the tale. But before setting off to convert the nation, he stopped back home in Wisconsin to try again with his parents. When he gets there, he learns they'd already actually softened on Mormonism without him, and some of his family had actually converted, you know, the spirit of Elijah and all of that going on. Hamblin was elated and traveled with his 39-year-old companion, John Myers, to Maryland to preach the gospel of Mormonism. And I have to think the P-Day for these old guys would have been just a little different. Elder, let's not play basketball today. I think I pulled a hammy getting out of bed. I wrote those words, and I still feel attacked. 39-year-olds. A rough life. While Hamblin was gone, Joseph Smith and Hiram, obviously killed by a mob in Carthage, and nothing shuts down a presidential campaign faster than the death of the candidate. Or the phrase, but her emails. Too soon?
Now I really want to go look at the Hamblin thing and make sure that it's not in a footnote or something. During this time, Hamblin returns back to Nauvoo and is recruited in the Nauvoo Legion. Remember we talked about this? As, quote, one of the Minutemen to assist in watching the movements of the enemy. So he was sort of a spy in the Nauvoo Legion, which I think is kind of cool. He was watching the movements of the enemy. And in this case, it meant probably your next door neighbor. We should also point out that Hamblin had a growing reputation for healing the sick with his blessings. This man loved to offer and administer blessings and pronouncements that people would be healed. He would make a pronouncement and shortly after the sick person would be miraculously better. One of his famous healings apparently converted his cranky parents, and they joined Mormonism too. Compton says, quote, in the summer of 1845, Hamblin worked on the Nauvoo Temple, doing any jobs required of him. But the conflict with non-Mormons continued to escalate, and anti-Mormon vigilantes closed in around Nauvoo, burning and looting. Jacob once again became a Minuteman, serving both in a horse company and a rifle company. After taking part in the Nauvoo Legion action, possibly in September 1845, Jacob returned to Nauvoo and immediately was taken very sick with the bilious fever. I realize this is one of those bogus 19th century terms that covers like 300 conditions, but it does sound ominous. Bilious. Am I saying that right? Bilious? Bilious?
I've always thought
the ague, the egg, the og.
We don't have these terms anymore because we have, you know.
Medicine. If it wasn't on Oregon Trail, I don't know how to say it. That's just the bottom line.
You died of bilious fever.
Apparently now Jacob's the sick one, near death's door, but was brought back by a priesthood blessing. And at this time, Mormons were planning to head west, planning to abandon Nauvoo in the spring of 1846. So Hamblin helped find the timber to make wagons. Very Johnny Appleseed of him. But not Greenwood, though. He's not interested in pulling a Martin and a Willie. No. Jacob and Lucinda were some of the Mormons who got their endowments out in the Nauvoo Temple. They received their endowment on January 5th, 1846, so they were part of the group that they were sort of like rushing everyone through before they knew that they were going to, well, as they were getting out of town.
And that's kind of an interesting scene. Like we talked about, the pattern was the man would be taken through the veil into the thing representing the celestial kingdom, and then he would bring his wife through. So it had to be kind of a poignant moment because they all know they're leaving. So it's kind of this last spiritual hurrah before they take off.
Unless you're stuck with a wife you don't like Jacob Hamblin.
Unless you find no joy in your first wife.
Oh, I get to take her forever? Are we sure? What if I forget the name?
Now, here's the thing. The words pioneer children sing as they walked and walked and walked are true, but they don't cover everything. Remember, pioneer parents sing as they worked and worked and worked in various random places to save up money for the trip halfway across the damn country. Most of these folks were poor to begin with, and trying to scrape up enough to get your family in a wagon to Utah often meant staying in the Midwest for a couple of years. I mean, 5-6 years in some cases. And as the Hamblins negotiated this experience, their marriage crashed and burned. Hamblin divorces Lucinda and would recall the relationship bitterly for the rest of his life. I mean, the phrase finding no joy in your first wife is pretty... I think we get where he's headed with that.
What if he was the problem? I just want to say that, like, we only get his side of the story because he liked to write, but come on.
That generation of tough guys, these frontier dudes, they can't have been real great romantic companions.
If he's a young man being, I don't know. By all accounts later on, his plural wives love him. So could be Lucinda's fault. I'm obligated as a descendant to say he was perfect, but...
I'll give you that. You can do that. You can pull the descendant card. That's cool. See, because the family lore says that his second wife, Rachel, would say Lucinda wasn't a bad person. She was just weak and didn't have the courage to come to Utah. Yeah, that doesn't sound great. But again, descendant card. Lindsay pulled it. We're going to leave it there. Hamblin knows he needs a wife to help with his children, and so he chooses Rachel Henderson that we just mentioned. She was quiet, shy, and redheaded, look out, and had been previously married twice already. So, welcome to the Hamblin household. Her first husband was John E. Page, who was married to Rachel's older sister Mary, and then married Rachel as a plural wife, so maybe some baggage there, just a little bit. Rachel left Page when he left the church, not that we've ever heard that story before. Her second husband, James Henderson, died the first year of their marriage. This is how the 19th century worked. If one of the spouses doesn't die within the... I mean, what's that? That's probably their joke. Most small business marriages die in the first year.
I'm sure that was their joke, Brian. I'm sure they made that joke often.
You go down to like the mercantile, it was a hot one. Always got laughs at the mercantile, so...
Always got laugh. That's our new shirt. Always got laugh at the mercantile.
That one always got laughs.
People are sending us all kinds of designs and what do we call it? Merch?
We're getting memey around here. We're getting memey,
so there's one.
There you go. So Rachel leaves with the three stepchildren and joins Hamblin's family. She was afraid that because the first two marriages of hers didn't produce biological children, that she wouldn't be able to conceive. Genuine fear. There might have been a problem in other families, but not in Jacob Hamblin's family, because he has the gift of prophecy. He told Rachel that she would, quote, bear children like Jacob and Rachel of old, Our sons shall be Joseph and Benjamin. How convenient. If he marries, you know, somebody named Drusilla, or some other lace-covered vintage nonsense name, this story would have been significantly less cool. He has to marry Rachel. It's, you know, it's prophecy. Hamblin wrote, quote, I have had peace at home or in my family ever since I have lived with this kind, affectionate companion. I have tasted the bitter. I know well how to appreciate the sweet. P.S. Screw you, Lucinda.
That's a little Victorian passive aggression for you, yeah, right there.
We can't imagine what he's talking about there.
Okay, so their overland travel didn't happen until 1850, which surprised me that Hamblin was left later. He wasn't some of the early arrivals in Utah, because I see him as like this great frontiersman, but he was a little bit slow planting apples all over the Midwest. No.
Probably telling jokes down at the mercantile. It took up all his time.
Probably. It's good to remember that he doesn't leave until 1850 because he is a trusted Indian scout. And like I said, I always thought he was an early adopter in the Great Basin, but nope, 1850. The family's journey was very quintessential legacy-type Mormon stuff. Wagon boxes floating in the river, near-death experiences, healings, blessings, and lots of cholera. Lots of cholera. Like, seriously, so much cholera. I read and read and read about cholera. It just drains you from all the places. And it happened to him. So, someone on Twitter recently asked, do you really think people in the past had as many stomach problems like you hear about today? Seriously, you guys, if you're saying that stuff and you're thinking it's the food that we're eating and it's all the Doritos and Cheez-Its I'm eating, you can't go two pages in a diary without diarrhea and cholera morbus. Like, it's leaking everywhere onto every page, if you will. Mormons are done with the ague, and now it's all about cholera all the time. We're done with the swampy mosquitoes, and we're just going to be drained of cholera. And because I can't be the only one who knows a lot about cholera, let's let my main man, Brother Compton, bring us in. Quote, this disease, which was especially prevalent in the hot months of July and August, was caused by unsanitary conditions and infected water, which were typical of the camps of many rushed gold seekers. The symptoms of cholera began with extreme severe diarrhea involving what pioneer doctors called rice water evacuations, followed by violent vomiting. Then there was a complete physical collapse of prostration. The pulse lessened to near imperceptibility, the eyes seemed to sink into the face, the skin wrinkled, turning blue or purple, the body was cool to the touch. This was followed by violent cramping of muscles in the limbs and abdomen. If the victim survived the first day or two of cholera, he or she would regain warmth in the body and normal flesh color in the face. End quote. Jacob and his family got cholera and then survived it through what Hamblin believes was a miracle. Many in the company died. Basically, if your peeps traveled in the Aaron Johnson Company with Jacob Hamblin, they probably either survived cholera or died from it. Guaranteed there was some diarrhea-based faith crisis and diarrhea-based faith-promoting stories for
years.
There's
a Facebook group for that somewhere.
It's a regional one. You have to look real hard to find it. So finally, with all the cholera, they arrived in Salt Lake City on September 6th, 1850.
They were pooped out probably when they got here? Is that
really? That's the best you got from that one?
I gotta go back down to the mercantile and brush up my five-minute act here. All right, now, we hope to get into all the wild adventure in Utah later on, because there's a lot to say about Mr. Hamblin in Utah. But for now, we're going to drop him off at his arrival in Utah, and we'll pick him back up again when we get into the Utah period. Rules are rules, people. Don't make me quote the Constitution to you.
To this week's Before They Were Famous episode, I'm going to talk about a Mormon who never got famous because he died too young. Welcome to Never Got Famous with historian Christopher Smith. The star of our segment this week is Jonathan Dunham. You've probably never heard that name before, which is weird because Dunham was actually kind of a big deal in Mormon Nauvoo. He was the captain of the Nauvoo police, and he was the second highest ranking officer in the Nauvoo Legion after Joseph Smith himself. Basically, this guy was Nauvoo's top enforcer in the last couple years of Joseph Smith's life. He was involved in some real shenanigans, including a mission to kidnap some witnesses to stop them from testifying against one of the Danites, as well as a supposed plot to murder William Marks and William Law. The odd thing about Dunham is that he showed no sign of being a violent person before about 1838. Unlike Porter Rockwell, one of the other major enforcers of early Mormonism, who was a rowdy by nature, Dunham was an entrepreneur and an intellectual. He ended up as Joseph's chief enforcer not because he had any special proclivity to violence, but because he was a talented leader and absolutely loyal to Joseph Smith. Prior to his Mormon baptism, Dunham lived in a New York frontier village called Rushford, where he worked as a carpenter. One of the buildings that he constructed as a young man was Rushford's First Methodist Church, which he attended before he became a Mormon. He married a young Methodist woman named Mary Kendall, with whom he had two children who survived to adulthood, Albert and Marcia. A few years before converting to Mormonism, Dunham became a partner in a stagecoach business. He also served as a constable, which apparently was his first introduction to police and enforcement work. His account book from this period suggests that he was a very good provider for his family. He purchased lots of food, medicine, clothing, shoes, and construction materials for the house. One entry says that he sold some pups, which suggests that they had at least one pet dog. And another entry indicates that he bought his wife a pair of nice calfskin boots. So they lived fairly well, but Mormonism changed all that. From the time of his baptism in 1835 until his death in 1845, Dunham was away on missions more often than not. He left on his first mission shortly after his baptism. He was a pretty successful missionary, and within a few months he'd baptized 18 people and established a new branch of the church. Over the next 10 years, he would serve four more missions and travel thousands of miles. According to his journal, dozens of people were miraculously healed when he prayed for them. But all of this missionary success came at the expense of his family. Whenever he was away, his wife Mary depended heavily on financial support from her parents to take care of the children. In fact, not once, not twice, but three times while he was away, Mary had to move the family to a new home without her husband's help, and even without his approval. And life wasn't much better for Jonathan on the road. Mormon missionaries went without purse or scrip, meaning they didn't take any supplies with them. They lived as beggars on the road, totally dependent on the charity of the people they visited. Hunger is one of the biggest themes of both Jonathan Dunham's missionary journal and his patriarchal blessing. He never had quite enough to eat. But if anything, the suffering that he endured for the gospel on the missionary trail only made him even more committed to this new religion. Dunham moved his family to Kirtland, Ohio by 1837, when his son Albert attended the Kirtland High School. We have Albert's penmanship practice notes, and he was required to write the phrase, "Beauty is the pride of a female's heart." They started him young on the misogyny in Kirtland, Ohio. That year, Dunham received two blessings that commanded him to go as a missionary to the Lamanites. From then on, he went on several missions to Native Americans. One of my favorite Jonathan Dunham stories is a letter he sent to the church leaders in Kirtland when he was on his way to New York to preach to the Lamanites there. We don't have the actual letter, but we have a summary by a Kirtland High Counselor named Thomas Burdick, who wrote to Joseph Smith to complain about Dunham's letter. Several teachings in Dunham's letter alarmed Burdick, including that the United States were about to be destroyed, and that the Lost Tribes of Israel are flying through space somewhere on a detached planet that used to be attached to the Earth's North Pole. Weirdly, Dunham signed this letter, J. Dunham Lamanite. If you're thinking that means this guy had Native American ancestry, you'd be wrong. He was a lily white Brit on both sides of the family. I've traced his genealogy all the way back to Britain. So why is he claiming in this letter to be a Lamanite? I have no idea. It's possible that one of the Native American groups he visited had adopted him as an honorary member of the tribe. Or it's possible that this was just kooky Jonathan Dunham being kooky. Dunham's radicalization began in 1838, when he led a group of refugees from Kirtland, Ohio, to Missouri to escape persecution in Kirtland. But when he arrived in Missouri, he found it in a state of war. Dunham was immediately appointed to captain a company of 50 Danites, and he was ordered to go steal livestock from Gentile farms. According to Thomas B. Marsh, the Mormons playfully referred to his company as the Fur Company, to captured cattle as buffalo, and to Dunham himself as Captain Blackhawk, as if he were a famous Indian buffalo hunter. When the Mormons eventually lost the Missouri War and surrendered their weapons, Dunham broke his sword in three pieces over his knee before he threw it down. Dunham's valor as a Danite captain in the Missouri War earned him a place as Joseph Smith's trusted confidant in Nauvoo. In December 1843, Joseph established a Nauvoo police force and named Dunham its captain or high policeman. The rumor around Nauvoo was that the police were a continuation of the Danites from Missouri, and that Joseph Smith had founded the police force to ferret out and kill traitors. In fact, the policemen themselves apparently believed this, because a couple of the policemen privately warned William Law and William Marks that Joseph had declared them traitors and ordered the police to murder them. Joseph was hopping mad that someone had spilled this secret, and he gave a sermon to the police in which he said, "Captain Dunham is the man to send after a thief. He will not come back after following him a mile to ask if he may shoot him if he resists." In other words, Joseph trusted Dunham because he believed Dunham wouldn't hesitate to kill the church's enemies. He wouldn't think twice, and he wouldn't ask for permission. On another occasion, Joseph sent Dunham and a group of policemen across the river to kidnap and possibly kill Ebenezer Richardson and Mark Childs, who were both scheduled to testify in court against a Danite named Daniel Avery, who had been arrested as a horse thief. Richardson saw them coming and screamed, "Murder! Murder!" And the policemen went running back across the river with a bunch of angry non-Mormons hot on their trail. Dunham was also the major general of the Nauvoo Legion, and there is a mystery around his management of the Legion. A Nauvoo Danite named Alan Joseph Stout claimed in his memoirs that while Joseph Smith was in the Carthage jail awaiting trial, he wrote an official order for Jonathan Dunham to bring the Legion and preserve him from being killed, but Dunham did not let a single man or mortal know that he had received such orders, and we were kept in the city under arms. D. Michael Quinn interprets this source as meaning that Smith ordered Dunham to rescue him from the jail, but that Dunham refused the order because he knew it would lead to bloodshed. I think Quinn is wrong here because there's another source that Quinn missed that clarifies what Stout is saying. John D. Lee, another Nauvoo Danite, says in his memoir that Dunham told him that the prophet requested him to take his command and ambush it in a grove near Carthage and watch the movements of the crowd, but Dunham dared not go contrary to the orders of the governor. This clarifies things because it suggests that Dunham's orders were not to rescue Joseph or to break him out of jail, but just to station the Legion where it could watch the crowd to make sure that the mob didn't try to kill Joseph. Dunham failed to obey this order not because he refused it on principle, but because the state militia occupied Nauvoo and took command of the Legion right before Dunham received this order. And so the situation had changed and made it impossible for him to follow the order without starting a war. Jonathan Dunham died almost exactly 1 year later while away on a Native American mission. Rumors claimed that he had either committed suicide or that he was murdered because of his failure to save Joseph Smith. D. Michael Quinn accepts these rumors as fact. Personally, I think it's more likely that, as his traveling companions reported, he died of a fever after a 3-week illness at a particular Missouri physician's house. But the suicide and murder rumors were pretty widespread, and I can't rule out the possibility that Dunham either killed himself or was killed. At the very least, the fact that such rumors spread and gained credence with the faithful in Nauvoo says a lot about what kind of place that city had become in 1845.
Okay, for our Before They Were Famous, Last the Best of All the Game. Sure, Jacob Hamblin is cool. I really like his stories, and we learn a lot about local bands of Paiutes from his experiences, from the white perspective. But few people match up to the next character in our Before They Were Famous roster. On deck is Jane Elizabeth Manning James. If you don't know this name, schedule an appointment with your bishop and tell him you need to repent, because Jane is a really important figure in early Mormonism. Her name should be remembered as famously as at least more than John D. Lee. My goodness.
She was really unlikely to try to kill you, I would guess. So
her body count was low and her good works were high. You can't say that about all the men that we know in Mormonism.
Her ratios were good.
Most often in history, it's told about the folks who had the most power, and this is why this is a problem. Same thing goes for Mormon history, and so when people tell the story of Mormonism, we usually talk most about the leaders, Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, and a few of those other guys, but mostly Joseph Smith. But if you want to know more of a complete story of what really happens in history, you really have to look to the margins of society, because they tell you as much about the story, if not more.
The story of Jane Manning James does exactly that. Her story is remarkable, not only because she was an influential pioneer in the Mormon movement, but she was also a Black American woman who left a record in her own words. One of the challenges you face in exploring the history of the marginalized is they won't always have the same access and voice that tells their story. Because of this, we don't have a lot of the personal stories of Black Americans in the 19th century, especially as compared to their white counterparts. And that's a shame, because their histories matter every bit as much as those around them. And the absence of their voices can actually tell us something too. When it comes to Jane, one of the first early African-American converts to Mormonism, we have her own words. Around 1893, she sat down, and there's a reason why it was then, and again, patience, we'll talk about that, and she told her story to Elizabeth J.D. Roundy. We're going to use her words as much as possible, just because they truly are a rare treat in the history of 19th century American African pioneers.
And there's actually two dates, and I was going to ask you, Brian, if you knew this, if those were two different accounts, because the LDS.org cites it as 1900. Do you know?
I think there are two main ones. As I recall, Quincy talks about that. And I think, yeah, there's kind of two major sort of reminiscent accounts where she goes over her conversion. And
when we talk about Jane later on, we should have Quincy on, because we can talk about that later. Good stuff. Jane was born in Wilton, Connecticut, probably between 1812 and 1830, and that's a huge gap. Her gravestone lists a birth date all the way up to 1822, but again, it's hard with, you know, enslaved people, it's hard with freed Black people of this time. Records were just hard to come by when you were marginalized. You either didn't have access to education to learn to write them, or you didn't keep notes the way the white elite did. But we do know something about her birth. Her parents were Isaac Manning and Eliza Phyllis. Slavery was said to be pretty rare in Connecticut at this time. It was still legal until it was abolished in 1848. So when she was born, it was still legal, but kind of frowned upon. And that's important to know. We always act, especially, you know, as a white Mormon girl growing up in Utah, that slavery was just the law of the land at the time, and everyone thought it was fine. That's actually not true. most people, except for the slave owners themselves, saw the horrors of it. They saw the exploitation of it, and they were against it. That's why you use systems of violence to enforce it, because people didn't like it. But Jane's parents were free blacks, and they were eking out a rural living with their family. Even though they were free, that meant that there was a lot of discrimination and racism constantly. Remember, structurally, slavery was legal, so the protections for Black Americans were zero. Jane and her five siblings relied on one another and tried to help on the family property.
Here, Jane's going to bring us into her story. Quote, "When a child only 6 years old, I left my home and went to live with a family of white people. Their names were Mr. and Mrs. Joseph Fitch. They were aged people and quite wealthy. I was raised by their daughter. When about 14 years old, I joined the Presbyterian Church. Yet, I did not feel satisfied. It seemed to me there was something more that I was looking for. I had belonged to the church about 18 months when an elder of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints was traveling through our country and preached there. The pastor of the Presbyterian Church forbid me going to hear them. As he had heard, I had expressed a desire to hear them. But nevertheless, I went. 1 year after I was baptized, I started for Nauvoo with my mother, Eliza Manning, my brothers, Isaac, Lewis, and Peter, my sisters, Sarah Stebbings and Angeline Manning, my brother-in-law, Anthony Stebbings, Lucinda Manning, a sister-in-law, and myself. We started from Wilton, Connecticut, and traveled by canal to Buffalo, New York. We were to go to Columbus, Ohio, before our fares were to be collected, but they insisted on having the money in Buffalo and would not take us farther. So we left the boat and started on foot to travel a distance of over 800 miles.
This is where Jane's story takes on a sort of heroic mythos. She talks about her great desire to travel to Nauvoo and gather with the saints. Truthfully, if you haven't seen the movie Jane and Emma yet, that LDS playwright Melissa Leilani Larson created, put it on your list. It's great. I would definitely say there are faith-promoting elements, but the writing, the history is really important and well done. Melissa is a brilliant writer. It's got a lot of depth to it, and I would recommend the film for anyone because it really pulls from the source material that we have on her. Sisters in Zion were involved in that too. They helped build the character based on Jane's own writing, so it's definitely a piece of history worth watching. Back to Jane and what she had to say, quote, "We walked until our shoes were worn out and our feet became sore and cracked open and bled until you could see the whole print of our feet with blood on the ground. We stopped and united in prayer to the Lord, we asked God the Eternal Father to heal our feet, and our prayers were answered and our feet were healed forthwith. When we arrived at Peoria, Illinois, the authorities threatened to put us in jail to get our free papers. We didn't know at first what he meant, for we had never been slaves. But he concluded to let us go, so we traveled on until we came to a river, and there was no bridge. We walked right into the stream. When we got in the middle, the water was up to our necks, but we got safely across. And then it became so dark we could hardly see our hands before us, but we could see a light in the distance. So we went towards it and found it was an old log cabin. Here we spent the night. The next day we walked for a considerable distance and stayed that night in a forest out in the open air. The frost fell on us so heavy that it was like a light fall of snow. We rose early and started on our way, walking through that frost with our bare feet until the sun rose and melted it away. But we were on our way rejoicing, singing hymns and thanking God for his infinite goodness and mercy to us in blessing us as he had, protecting us from all harm, answering our prayers and healing our feet. In course of time, we arrived at La Harpe, Illinois, about 30 miles from Nauvoo. At La Harpe, we came to a place where there was a very sick child. We administered to it, and the child was healed. I found that the elders had before this given it up, and they did not think it could live. We had now arrived to our destined haven of rest, the beautiful Nauvoo. Here, we went through all kinds of hardship, trial, and rebuff, but we at last got to Brother Orson Spencer's. He directed us to the Prophet Joseph Smith's mansion."
And Joseph Smith apparently welcomed the family personally with open arms. The James family found a lot of racism within Nauvoo, but they also found a form of acceptance. We'll talk more about her experiences in Utah in other episodes that will show some of this discrimination. And you have to remember, she's facing this in her own faith community. That had to have been hard. But at least her later accounts of the Smith family were favorable. She found work washing and cleaning for Emma Smith, where she claims Lucy Mack showed her the Urim and Thummim, saying, quote, "You will live long after I am dead and gone, and you can tell the Latter-day Saints that you was permitted to handle the Urim and Thummim." It's a cool story.
Yeah, and it's something interesting about Hamblin, too. They both have this parallel where they both have the gift of healing, but her as a woman and as a Black woman without the priesthood, you know, that's an interesting component. She doesn't feel like she needed it at all. She just healed the sick and even said the elders couldn't do it, but we did this. And also this idea of talking to a member of the Smith family and, you know, them telling you something special. That was kind of a common theme.
Her relationship with Emma and Lucy is very interesting. I've always thought that part of her story is fascinating.
And that's why the movie's worth watching, because it really is a story about Emma and Jane and their relationship. And I like that it shows that Emma is racist towards Jane. I don't want to spoil too much, but spoiler, white Mormons have a problem with this still. And Emma was no different. And yeah, it's a really good way to watch this play out, because Melissa really goes into their relationship. Here's how Jane describes the Smith family in her own words, quote, "Brother Joseph took a chair and sat down by me and said, 'You have been the head of this little band, haven't you?' I answered, 'Yes, sir.' He then said, 'God bless you. Now I would like you to relate your experience and your travels.' I related to them all that I have above stated and a great deal more minutely, as many incidents had passed from my memory since then. But Joseph slapped Dr. Bernheisel on the knee and said, 'What do you think of that, doctor? Isn't that faith?' The doctor said, 'Well, I rather think it is. If it had been me, I fear I should have backed out and returned to my home.' He then said, 'God bless you. You are among friends now and you will be protected.' They sat and talked to us a while, gave us words of encouragement and good counsel. We all stayed there 1 week, by the time all but myself had secured homes. Brother Joseph came in every morning to say good morning and ask how we were. During our trip, I had lost all my clothes. They were all gone. My trunks were sent by canal to the care of Charles Wesley Wandle. One large trunk full of clothes and of all descriptions, mostly new. On the morning that my folks all left to go to work, I looked at myself clothed in the two pieces I possess. I sat down and wept. Brother Joseph came into the room and as usual and said, 'Good morning. Why, not crying, are you?' 'Yes, sir,' I said. 'The folks have all gone and got themselves homes, and I have got none.' He said, 'Yes, you have. You have a home right here if you want it. You mustn't cry. We dry up all our tears here.' I said, 'I have lost my trunk and all my clothes.' He asked how I had lost them. I told them I put them in the care of Charles Wesley Wandus and paid him for them, and he has lost them. Brother Joseph said, 'Don't cry. You shall have your trunk and clothes again.' Brother Joseph went out and brought Sister Emma in and said, 'Sister Emma, here is a girl that says she has no home. Haven't you a home for her?' 'Why, yes, if she wants one.' He said, 'She does.' And then he left us. Sister Emma said, 'What can you do?' I said, 'I can wash, iron, cook, and do housework.' Then she said, 'When you are rested, you may do the washing if you would just as soon do that.' I said, 'I'm not tired.' 'Well,' she said, 'you may commence your work in the morning.'" End quote. I love that story because it shows, first, that Jane is a fantastic writer, right? She really like captures the character of it. And I think that it shows that Joseph was to allow a Black family to stay in your home and not as servants for a week is pretty remarkable, I think, for a lot of people of that time. So yeah, she has this great, remarkable experience and relationship with Joseph Smith and Emma Smith. And that's important because it helps frame an experience that would define her entire life later on in Utah. And this is the experience. She says, quote, "Sister Emma asked me one day if I would like to be adopted to them as their child, and I did not answer her. She said, 'I will wait a while and let you consider it.' She waited 2 weeks before she asked me again. When she did, I told her, 'No, ma'am,' because I did not understand or know what it meant. They were always good and kind to me, but I did not know my own mind. I did not comprehend."
The issue of her sealing, it's a complicated one, and we'll explain that later when we talk about the priesthood ban. Basically, Jane's spiritual relationship and sealing to the Smith family would be a hotly contested issue to white Mormons in the Utah period. Again, we'll talk about that, I promise. After Joseph Smith is killed, Jane lived in the home of another Mormon leader, Brigham Young. And that is the exact opposite of being upgraded to a suite when you check into your hotel. Here, she met her husband, Isaac James, a free Black man and one of the early Mormon converts in 1839. And sorry, Jane, to leave you on that note of getting moved to Brigham Young's house, but that is the end of your Nauvoo experience. and we'll pick her back up for some very interesting stories in Utah, because she really is at the center of the Temple Band for the rest of her life.
Yeah, and this experience she has with Emma, where Emma asks to adopt her, would leave her confused if she would think it was strange until later on. So just put a pin in that, as we're always asking you to do. And before we let you go, I just want to extend a personal invitation to you. If you like this podcast, please leave a donation at sunstone.org. And come join us for the Sunstone Summer Symposium this summer, July 28th through the 31st, 2021 in Salt Lake City, Utah. We are doing our symposium. Brian, we're back.
We will get to do some fun stuff personally. So we'll have a panel there. And we're also doing a trivia contest.
That's right. Brian and I will be there together. Are you going to be there with Benchmark most of the time?
We'll also be there with Benchmark. So books, trivia, panels.
We're going to have our swag there. You can buy some Sunstone Podcast swag. We have the designers who've been sending us in logos. You are making our day. It's so fun to get those in the inbox. And someone sent me a t-shirt in the mail that was amazing. So thank you for that. Brian and I are going to do a panel like we talked about. And while we do that, we're going to do a Mormon trivia contest. So if you want to sign up for that, Christina Rossetti is organizing, and there should be more information on online soon. So join us at sunstone.org. Register for the conference. I hope to see you all there. That's a great way to support Sunstone and have a fun time while you're doing it.
Yeah, you know, it's time for a Books of Mormons report here. And it's always a shame when somebody really interesting gets only a crappy biography. And for many years, that was the case with Jacob Hamblin. Pearson Corbett was probably a really nice guy, but his biographies were not great. So finally, Todd Compton got to work and published A Frontier Life, Jacob Hamblin, Explorer and Indian Missionary. And yeah, of course, you know that guy's name, as this is the same Todd Compton of In Sacred Loneliness fame. So you're going to get the same research skills here. He takes advantage of the many diaries and correspondence and things that he left. So really well done biography.
And another fun one to look at is an older one published in 1980. It's Juanita Brooks's biography of Jacob Hamblin, Jacob Hamblin, Mormon Apostle to the Indians. As long as Juanita was writing history, she wanted to write about Jacob Hamblin. She was trying to always collect stuff on him. She found him fascinating. And she actually started basically an early publication. But, and there's some really fun arguments she got in with. She would argue with an anti-Mormon historian at the time about if Jacob Hamblin was involved in the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Because at that time, they didn't know. Now we know that he wasn't there for that. But she was trying to solve that mystery. And she does in this book. But of course, Todd Compton's is the most recent one and has, it's phenomenal, the source material he was able to dig up on that. So check out Juanita Brooks's one if you have time too.
Now for Jane Manning, she was also rescued from mostly subpar stuff when Quincy Newell, who interestingly enough was a non-Mormon and became very interested in her life and wrote Your Sister in the Gospel, The Life of Jane Manning James, a 19th Century Black Mormon. So outside of those late-in-life reminiscent accounts that we talked about, Jane didn't leave a whole lot else in her own words. So Quincy, who was an expert in 19th Century Black history, particularly religious history, was able to go back and then fill in some of those gaps, and she did a really good job. It's a very concise, very well-written account of this really interesting woman.
Brother Young, and let it smoke ascend to heaven, Brother Brigham, Brother Young, and let my breast be cut asunder, Brother Young, as an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.